With Ishmael's answer in this, at least in the logic of this commentary, we have already the beginning of a, I would call this, to save time, secularization. That is a way of transforming heteronomy, this asymmetrical situation in which the baby, the young boy, is circumcised before understanding, before speaking. He is inscribed in the community before having anything to know and to think and to see and to say. So Ishmael is trying to transform this asymmetrical covenant into a somewhat symmetrical, autonomous contract. And that's the beginning of secularization, the transition from heteronomy to some autonomy. But at the same time, what Ishmael claims is that since he is prepared to make this sacrifice at an age when one understands, he is more, let's say, ready to enter the covenant which remains asymmetrical. So there is this competition. But the other version that you mentioned, another version says, Isaac retorted, all that you did was to lend the Holy One, blessed be he, 3 drops of blood, that is circumcision, 3 drops of blood, even if you are 13. But I'm now 37 years old, yet if God desired of me that I be slaughtered, I would not refuse. So there is this auction, in a certain way, between the two. Now, of course, I was circumcised when I was 7 days without understanding anything, but now if God demands or asks me to do even more, to be slaughtered, now as an adult, I would accept. So there is this auction, one wanting to be more obedient and more submitted, more subjected to God in an asymmetrical way than the other. And of course, it is difficult to read this commentary without having one's eyes in the direction of what's happening today in many parts of the world, in Jerusalem, among others, in this war about who has been more true to God, more subject to heteronomy, in a certain way, that is, more of a believer. That, if I had time, I would go in that direction, in the political direction. But when I say political, and there's a lot to be said about politics and Judaism and Islam and Christianity today, needless to say. But when I say political, I point to this level, this human level, which has been exceeded by the very first moment in this history, when Abraham is given the order. It's no more, we have no more to do with ethics, politics, and law, and legal, and the law in the sense of legal, if not justice. So how are we to translate these metapolitical, transpolitical situation into the politics of our time? That's what politics are about today. How can we translate this reference, this Abrahamic reference, Ibrahimic reference, to this situation and into the political, the geopolitical situation today? It's a matter of translation, not only of a commentary on these commentaries, but how are we to translate this non-political, non-ethical, or trans-ethical, trans-political situation into the political responsibilities which are ours today? Matter of negotiations, again, in the most risky negotiations. But the fact is that if one wants to be rigorous in this negotiation, we have to, at the same time, keep in mind the specificity of ethics and politics and the irreducible specificity of this trans-political and trans-ethical situation. So on the one hand, you have, let's say, Kierkegaard insisting on the trans-ethical stage, you know, the religious level. And on the other hand, someone like Levinas, who says, well, in fact, in this situation, that's where Levinas opposes Kierkegaard. In that situation, what is most important is not the fact that Abraham was ready to sacrifice, as one says, in a wrong way, to sacrifice. The most interesting point is the angel who spends the sacrifice. That in fact, this unethical situation, the murder, because it's a murder. Kierkegaard says it's a murder. We have to keep in mind that Abraham was a murderer, was a criminal in terms of ethics. For Levinas, well, what matters here is not the fact that Abraham was ready to kill his son, but the fact that God interrupted the slaughter.
My first question had to do with prayer, and my second question has to do with God. So I want to ask you not so much about God, but about the name of God and how the name of God operates in your texts. As I understand deconstruction is always an affirmation. Arises from and leads up to an affirmation. Now, I would say, I mean, perhaps you would want to argue about this, but I would say that in the earlier writings and of grammatology and through the 70s, when you tended to use the name of God, you tended to refer to it in terms of theological closure. It was the name functioned as a way to arrest the play, or as a desire for a centered discourse, a transcendental signifier. But in the later writings, I have the sense that the emphasis has changed somewhat, and that the name of God has become a more open-ended name for you, more affirmative, and maybe we could say not so much a theological name as a religious name, and one that, for example, in Sophronom, you even speak of saving. So whether you're mentioning the name of God or using the name of God, and it would be interesting to know which is which and when you're doing which, and I'm not sure. But whether you're mentioning it or using it, what is going on with this name?
Thank you, John. A difficult question because, on the one hand, it's true that there has been a change, not, let's say, in my way of addressing these questions, but in the strategy of the text. It is true that at the time of what you call the earlier writings, I was speaking in a context in which the name of God was more, let's say, inscribed in what Heidegger would call ontotheological. That God as the absolute being, that is, being present, and so on and so forth, and playing in the system of, let's say, ontology, ontotheology, a certain role. So at that point, of course, when I said theological, I meant what you said. And even today, when I speak of sovereignty as an ontotheological phantasm or heritage, I have the same name of God in mind. But even then, at the time of grammatology, I had the, and there must be signs of it in these early texts, the feeling that the name of God doesn't function the way one usually thinks it functions. That is, and Hegel already said this, there is no example. God cannot be an example. The name of God is not a name among others. It must function differently. And to come to your distinction, to the distinction between mention and use, and we say whether you are mentioning this name or using it, and you add I'm often not sure when you are doing the one or the other. I'm not sure either, because if there is something unique in the name of God, in what it names, and in the way we name through it, there is something unique. That is, the distinction between mentioning and using is not pertinent anymore. If you want this distinction to work, you have to at least imply that when you use a word, there is a referent. I say, give me a glass, okay? When I mention the word glass, I mention the word, okay? I'm referring to a word, I'm not referring to a thing. Okay? Now, God, given precisely this deconstructive move, God is not the omnipotent first cause, prime mover, absolute being, absolute presence. So God is not something or some being that I could refer to by using the word God. The word God has an essential link to the possibility of being named. On the one hand, it's far beyond any given existence. It's transcendent any given form of being. So I cannot use the word God the way I use it for any finite being, on the one hand. And on the other hand, since God has an essential, it is assumed that the word God, that God thus named as an essential link to being named, being called, being addressed. So when I use the word God, I mention it. It's a word that I received as a word with no visible experience reference. So that this comes back to what I said about the prayer. When I pray, if I say God, if I address God, I don't know if I'm using the word God or mentioning the word God. And it is this this impossibility or the limit of the pertinence of this distinction between mention and use which makes religion possible, which makes God possible, which makes, let's say, the reference to God possible, the reference in terms of use or mention. So that's why in a number of texts which are more recent, I was attentive to precisely through text around Angelus Silesius and others to the name of God. The question is the name of God. And when I say the name of God, it's not a nominalistic suspicion. What are we doing when we name God? And what are the limits of this naming? Now, we know that in many precisely Abrahamic traditions, God is nameless, is what is beyond the name. In Jewish tradition, God is the empty place and beyond any name. But we name the nameless. We name what is nameless. And when we name what is quote unquote, what is not, what is or is not nameless, what do we do? And that's why being a believer, even a mystic believer, and being an atheistic person is not necessarily different. I know that the most authentic believers know that they are very close to pure atheism, because they know that using the word God, they may be simply mentioning it. And that to mention the word of God in a certain way is already an act of faith. The faith consists in, if there is a pure faith, I'm not sure, but if there is a pure faith, it consists in asking the question, when I use the word God, am I referring to someone or mentioning a name? Mentioning a name, not in the way grammarians or literary critics mention or quote. It's not a quote, but I may simply use the word as a word. But a word is not nothing. Naming, calling. I think Heidegger makes this interesting distinction between, let's say, nennen, to name, and heißen, and calling. When I mention the name of God, do I give a name, or do I call? Now, it's difficult to think the experience of naming without referring to the experience of calling. To name is to call. Now, if I am calling God, what I'm doing? What is it to call? Some, on the one hand, some non-believers will say, well, you're just calling. You're mentioning a name, just calling, that's a call. Others will say, well, the fact that I call is already not a proof, but a sign that God is the one who makes me call God. Okay? And the two say different things, but the same thing. The one says, well, when you call, when you name God, you call God. Well, that's you. You call. That's a call. That's you. You mention the word call. It's an empty call. Okay? And the other would say, well, if I feel the move, the motivation, the impulse to call God, it means that God is called through me. Okay? That there is something in me which calls God, and this is my faith. And the fact that the other says, the skeptical one says, well, it's just, let's say, nominalistic experience of calling, it's just part of my faith. Because if when I call, I was sure that there is someone, some real one at the other end, I wouldn't call. Okay? That's why the skeptical is part of the faithful one. If God was really present and as a sure and insured presence, I wouldn't call. And I wouldn't call anyone. I wouldn't call even Kevin, who is close to me, if I was sure that Kevin is really absolutely present to me. When I call him, it's because in a certain way he's not. He's not sure that he's just paying attention to me or simply present. Okay, so that's why between the skeptical one, the skeptic, and the faith, the believer, there is no mere contradiction. And that's what happens with this unique name of God. It doesn't mean, and just one postscriptum, doesn't mean that the name of God is unique in that respect. Because what I just said about the uniqueness of the name of God can be translated or transposed into or translated into any name of anyone. The name of anyone, even any finite being, it's the same situation. That's why I took the example of Kevin. It's the same structure. The same structure. And that's why what I call here faith is at the same time an exceptional, unique experience and something very, very common and very universal in certain way.
I asked before, Jacques, a question about the relations between deconstruction and Christianity, and I'd like to ask a question now about the relations between theology and deconstruction. It seems to me that theology is not just one humanities discipline among others. The theologian speaks and writes from within the sphere of faith, or perhaps more exactly, from within an intersection of the spheres of faith and reason. Although you've discussed various topics in mysticism and apophatic theology, and you've brooded on sacrifice and the two sources of religion, you've never written as a theologian. You've written about faith, about religious faith rather than theological faith, if I might borrow Thomas Aquinas' distinction. And I'd like to ask you a question about faith. Does deconstruction in theology meet an internal limit? If someone has theological faith, that's to say in the Christian tradition, confesses to a belief in Jesus as the Christ, does that limit what deconstruction can do in that person's thought? Or does it offer another context in which deconstruction works, albeit differently than in other contexts?
I understand, you'll tell me if I understand you correctly, that what you call theological faith as opposed to religious faith implies the reference to an historical event, that is Jesus. If someone, you say, has theological faith, confesses to believe in Jesus as the Christ, does that limit what the construction can do in that person's thought? That is, what you call theology here is a way of relying on revelation, whereas religious faith is something more universal?
Theological faith is that which arises from grace given by God.
Mm-hmm. Well, about grace given by God, deconstruction as such has nothing to say or to do. If it's given, let's say, to someone in a way which is absolutely improbable, that is, exceeding any proof, in a unique experience, then deconstruction has no lever on this, and should not have any lever. But once this grace, this given grace, is embodied in a discourse, in a community, in a church, in a religion, in a theology, that's why the word theological is a little troubling to me. When it is embodied in a body of discourses, institutions, and so on and so forth, then deconstruction may have something to say, something to do, without let's say questioning or suspecting the moment of grace, but about the consequences, the discourses, the institutions, the authority, the law, the politics, which might be the consequences of this grace. Yes, deconstruction has something to do while respecting the possibility of this grace. But the possibility of this grace is not accessible. It's not publicly accessible. And on that point of view, I'm really Kierkegaardian. The experience of faith is something which exceeds language in a certain way, ethics, politics, society, and in front, not in front, because we're never in front of this, but in relation to this experience of faith, deconstruction is totally useless and disarmed. And perhaps it's not simply the weak part of deconstruction. It's perhaps because deconstruction starts from this possibility of, if not the given grace, but this secret, this absolutely secret experience, which I would compare to what you call grace. That's perhaps the starting point of any deconstruction. That's why deconstruction is totally disarmed, totally useless when it reaches that point.
Back in 1995, John Caputo, as a faithful secretary or extra scriver, wrote a commentary on the gift of death. And this is how he translated your passage about what would happen if Abraham were to sacrifice on the top of Montmartre instead of on Moriah in Jerusalem, in the incendiary Middle East where we expect such things to happen. He wrote this: "Were a man later this week to take his son and head up to the top of the World Trade Center with the intention of offering his son in sacrifice, we would send a SWAT team to seize the man and put him under arrest for attempted murder for denying the most elemental command of ethics, which is not to deal in death." 7 years ago, John's translation was comically illustrative, and now it makes us tremble in ways we could never have anticipated. My question is, how should we read yours and John's glosses on De Silentio and a certain Abraham or Ibrahim at home in Europe and America after what we now call 9/11, after the World Trade Center collapsed under the impact of knife and fire, murdering over 3,000 sons and daughters, and after Mohammed Atta, hijacker of American Airlines Flight 11, left a note saying that his parents should be like Ibrahim, who willingly offered up their son to death?
It's a very, very dangerous question. I admire that Jack, in 1995, already took the example of the World Trade Center, replacing my reference to Montmartre, a very peaceful Montmartre, replacing it by the WTC. Although already in 95, and I don't say this to ignore your merit, in 95 already there had been a bombing in the World Trade Center. And the World Trade Center is, of course, the mountain, the highest point in this country, in a certain way. Now, it's the Tower of Babel, in a certain way. Not the Mount Moriah, but the Tower of Babel, which, as you remember, has been destroyed by God, in a certain way, because of the arrogance of the people who built the Tower of Babel. Of course, we could take a number of other examples today of, let's say, terrible sacrifices or terrible, terrible murders, collective murders, coming from above through a number of planes, bombing, and etc. I won't give other examples, but simply I would like to signal that there might be a number of other examples of this situation today. Now, Yvonne's question is, how should we read yours and Jacques' glosses on the silencio and a certain Ibrahim at home in Europe and America after 9/11 and so on and so forth, and after Mohamed Atta, hijacker of American Airlines flight 11, left a note saying that his parents should be like Abraham Ibrahim, who willingly offered up their son to death. First, the comparison stops very quickly, because even if the parents of Mohamed Atta were ready to offer their sons, in the case of Abraham and Isaac, there was no collective murder. There was just a victim, or someone sacrificed. Whereas in that case, he didn't simply commit suicide. He killed thousands of people by the same. So does that mean that the comparison doesn't work at all? If we seriously address the question of the political, military, historical consequences of the sacrifice of Abraham, of Isaac, in the world since that time, in the name of these traditions, millions of people have been killed and are still being killed. So I don't know what the interpretation might be. My first reaction would be, in any case, whether one considers the suicidal aspect or the murders, the collective murders, the consequences of this reference to the divine order is on the side of death. And I cannot see any justification whatsoever for killing. Even if I use the example, the remarkable exemplary example of Abraham and Isaac, to say, and that's what Jack was commenting upon, to say that each time we have to make a choice, we are in this situation. Okay? Even if I use this example as paradigmatic, I would not draw the consequence that the choice of, let's say, killing, a choice against life, might be justifiable in any way. Abraham remains a criminal on earth from the point of view of what one calls life. Abraham remains a criminal, and Mohamed Atta also. Okay. And a suicide bomber is a criminal. One who kills himself first and kills a number of people. Okay. So from that point of view, I could find no justification whatsoever in these languages. But as you know, crimes of war, crimes at war, are always, especially now, allegedly justified by religious reasons. Even in Bush's discourse, when he speaks of the going at war against the axis of evil, God bless America, and so on and so forth, we have some fundamentalist religious justification, alleged justification. So I can find no justification whatsoever in this reference to a sacrifice. So my own, let's say, own discourse would be simply against any justifiable, justified killing and suicide. If I had to address this question politically today, I would multiply the examples, despite the terrible example that you choose, and despite all the compassion that we may have for the victims of this 9/11 crime, we would have to take other examples today and to evaluate politically what the situation is. Next.
Skip the four. Skip number three.
Back in October of 2001, when you were at Villanova, you made a remark about the powerlessness of God, which I found very interesting and fascinating. And I wonder if we can talk a little bit about that. What you said was, God is supposed to be absolutely powerful in our tradition, and that you are trying to think of some divinity dissociated from power, if that is possible. And then you added, because a lot of people would say this, you added that there is in Jesus Christ some weakness, some vulnerability, some powerlessness, but that for you, this powerlessness, of course, is also a sign of the Almighty. And then you concluded this would have heavy ethical and political consequences, and it would deserve a long, much longer answer. So maybe we can take a moment to add something to that now and talk a little bit about what you meant by the powerlessness of God, and it's a counterintuitive idea in some ways, that to dissociate God from power goes against the very idea of God as omnipotent, as a fundamental classical conception of God. So in what sense could God lack power and still be God? And what would motivate you to talk about God in terms of powerlessness?
Thank you. Well, on the one hand, there is nothing original, absolutely original, in saying that there might be some, not absolute powerlessness, but some powerlessness in God. Even if one considers God as infinite, we know through the Bible, for instance, that there are moments in Genesis or in which God, I wouldn't say repents, because there is a problem of translation here, but God realizes that he has not done something which couldn't be improved. So there is some finitude in God's infinity. Then in Hegel, you could understand that despite God's infinity, God goes out of itself or himself and in nature and becomes finite, and to that extent limited in his power. And there are a number of examples of such a tradition. But this is not the way I, and of course, Jesus Christ's vulnerability or weakness. But this is not the way I approach this possibility of a powerless God. My starting point had to do with the problem of sovereignty. And I tried again and again to dissociate two concepts which are usually indissociable, that is the unconditionality and sovereignty. Indivisibility, unconditionality and sovereignty. And I would like to think of something unconditional in forgiving, in the grace, in forgiveness, in the gift, in hospitality, some unconditionality which wouldn't be a sign of power, a sign of sovereignty. So I try to dissociate sovereignty and unconditionality. And if I think of God on the side of, let's say, grace, forgiveness, hospitality, unconditionality, unconditional law, then in order to not to have to agree with what I call the ontotheological tradition of sovereignty, one has to dissociate God's sovereignty from God's from God, from the idea of a God. God without sovereignty, God without omnipotence, God without absolute power. And if one thinks of this possibility of the name of God being dissociated from the absolute power, then this would be a strategical and political lever to think of unconditionality without sovereignty and to deconstruct the politics of the political concept of sovereignty today, which is I would argue, which is a heritage of ontotheology, the history of the concept of sovereignty, which is today, of course, let's say, undergoing a terrible crisis with an earthquake all over the world, with nation states trying to keep the sovereignty and others trying to challenge this sovereignty. So today the political problems in international law are problems of sovereignty. So and we have to think differently about sovereignty and to deconstruct the tradition, the ontotheological tradition of sovereignty. And from that point of view, if we want to keep what I call the unconditional, the reference to the unconditionality in gift, in hospitality, in forgiveness, and so on, so we have to dissociate sovereignty and unconditionality. And then to dissociate what one calls God and absolute power. And perhaps this comes close to some Christian motive, the one you just mentioned. Then we would have to rethink the vulnerability and powerlessness of Jesus without the absolute power, which nevertheless remains in the tradition, the foundation of, let's say, the last recourse of this Christianity. If it's as weak and vulnerable that Jesus Christ represents, so to speak, or incarnates God, then the consequence would be that God has some powerlessness in himself. Or the other way around, that in fact the weakness, the powerlessness of Jesus is the human part of the passion, whereas God remains absolute power. That's a choice or a decision which has to be made within Christianity. Another Christian experience. I think tell me if you agree that there are the two movements in Christianity.
Yeah, and you're suggesting the more radical possibility. I mean, the more traditional one would be to say that there is a vulnerability in Jesus, but God retains God's absolute power. But to say that there's a vulnerability in God and a genuine powerlessness in God, and that Jesus incarnates that, is more interesting.
More interesting,
but less common, no?
I think so.
Yeah.
From time to time, Jacques, you've made use of Heidegger's distinction between revelation and revealability, Offenbarung, Offenbarkeit. As usually received, the distinction asks us to think about the relative priority of revelation and revealability. Does revelation precede revealability, making conditions of manifestation apparent only after the fact? Or are conditions of revealability in place before revelation occurs? I'd like to invite you to reflect on the distinction. Is it a clear alternative, or should it be understood, as you hint now and again, as an aporia? You suggested in Politics of Friendship that rethinking the alternative by way of iterability might, and I quote from you, might at least give access to a structure of experience in which the two poles of the alternative cease to oppose one another to form another node, another logic, another chronology, another history, another relation to the order of orders. And I'd like to ask you if you could say a little more about this other structure of experience.
Thank you. In fact, what I could say would simply go along with what you just suggested. It is, it's an aporia, and as you know, the aporia for me doesn't mean simply a paralysis, a no way. It's on the contrary, the condition of proceeding, of making a decision, of going forward. The aporia